This is a destination check. If you were not intending to listen to this week's science podcast, you've come to the wrong podcast. But if you were, I'm science correspondent Joe Palka.
And I'm producer Giselle Grayson. Today, we have for you an update on the oil spill. We'll look at how useful it really may or may not be to clean the oil off of wildlife. And we'll hear from an engineer who says the very complexity of deep water drilling may be too much for people to handle.
Then on to art. Claude Monet, remember him? He painted many London landscapes at the beginning of the 20th century. Now we know exactly where he was standing when he did some of them, thanks to, of all people, a meteorologist. And we'll come back to the U.S. to hear from Richard Knox about the science behind medical marijuana. First, though, images of brown pelicans represent the oil spill and the cleanup efforts in the Gulf of Mexico. We've all seen pictures of the birds covered in oil and also seen folks trying to clean the oil off. But scientists debate whether washing off the birds helps or just prolongs their suffering. Nell Greenfield Boyce has that story.
Brian Sharp is an ornithologist who lives in Oregon. And lately, on the news, he's heard wildlife experts talking about their efforts to clean up oiled birds.
And they're saying, yes, we can save these birds, and yeah, we can take care of them.
He seriously doubts it.
They're not going to survive, many of them.
That's what Sharp believes based on studies he did in the wake of the Exxon Valdez accident. He looked at several species of seabirds affected by oil to see how long they lived after being washed and banded with ID tags. Based on tags that were later found, he says the majority of birds didn't last long after being released, just days or weeks.
When they're released, they're still incapacitated, they're still sick.
He says the birds hadn't been just covered in oil, they'd ingested it as they'd tried to preen. He does understand how agonizing it is to see the suffering of oiled birds, and thinks if people want to try to clean them, that's their choice.
Just so that they don't deceive themselves and the public that they're really having great grand results and saving lots and lots of a high proportion of the birds, because it's just the opposite.
Other scientists have come to a similar conclusion. One biologist in Germany recently has been widely quoted as saying that oiled birds should be left alone or euthanized. That really bothers Michael Fry. He's a toxicologist who works at the American Bird Conservancy, and he says some research doesn't support such a grim view.
The success at rehabilitation goes all over the map, from like 3% of the birds that are brought in to over 90% of the birds that are brought in.
He says a lot of things matter: the kind of oil, how long the birds are covered in oil, and the species of bird.
Loons and grebes are very delicate birds when it comes to oil spills. Gulls are tough birds. Penguins are very tough birds.
He says studies of African penguins cleaned after oil spills show that most survive and go on to successfully breed. Plus, he says, studies done years ago may not reflect the success rates that rescuers could have today. Modern rehabilitation techniques cause birds less stress, and birds are carefully monitored to make sure they're ready to be released.
The responders are getting much better at assessing the health of the birds.
But even if veterinary medicine has advanced, some scientists say it's not clear how much difference that makes.
I'd like to see a report, you know, with statistics and everything on how well these newer techniques are working.
Dan Anderson is a biologist at the University of California, Davis. He studied the effect of oil on birds. About 20 years ago, he collaborated with Fry to use radio tracking to follow brown pelicans in California that were cleaned after oil spills.
There was one bird that made it for 19 years, but most of the birds didn't even make it through the first 6 months.
And the survivors didn't seem to breed, at least during 2 years of tracking. Anderson says scientists should try to find out if brown pelicans in this latest spill fare any better.
The question is still under debate, and legitimately so. Some follow-up work on this oil spill needs to be done.
Workers who clean oiled birds also want to see more research on how the animals do once they're released. Mark Russell is with the International Bird Rescue Research Center, which is cleaning birds in the Gulf.
It seems to me it's a golden opportunity to find more information out.
But he says, in the absence of clear answers, the bird's suffering still demands action.
Until we know, we have a moral obligation to stay the course and care for these animals. And we owe it to each individual animal.
He says sometimes euthanasia may be the right choice. But if recovery seems possible, he thinks a bird should get that chance. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
There's a professor of engineering at the University of Texas named Ted Potsick. He claims that this oil spill was actually decades in the making. He testified on The Hill this week and said, quote, "Horrible things happen when complex technologies and procedures overtake humans who service them and wrongly think they're in control." Deb Amos talked to him about how this applies to drilling for oil in deep waters.
What did you want to tell Congress? Why did you start with such a dire prediction there?
Well, the prediction actually is not dire. We are struggling with this question not only in deep water, but in many other areas of engineering. We have created many, many very complex systems, which are very difficult to understand and sometimes difficult to control.
Is deep water drilling so different from all other kinds?
Yes, it is, because we are drilling in a remote, harsh environment. And we are also drilling very deep wells. Some of them are 13, 15,000 feet deep below the bottom of the sea, but others may go as much as 30,000 feet. And so this deep water environment is in fact often harsher than outer space. Crushing pressures, very high temperatures, and also sometimes chemical composition which causes corrosion of the wells.
Why was the technology developed to drill so deep?
Well, there's a very good reason, because that's where the oil is. We have to remember that easy oil onshore has been discovered, and its production essentially is declining worldwide.
Professor, how much oil does the U.S. get from deep water wells? Can we afford to stop?
No, we can't. Well, we can if you want to forgo driving, flying. The truth of the matter is that a third of all oil in the U.S. is produced in the Gulf of Mexico, and then 80% of it is produced in deep Gulf of Mexico. And then in the deep Gulf of Mexico, most of it is now produced in over 5,000 feet of water.
Are we at the edge of our technology? Is human understanding just not keeping up with this technology?
No, I wouldn't say that. From the science point of view, we do understand most of the difficulties that are there. It is their interface with humans that is not well understood. These are complex operations. They require large teams of people working together flawlessly. And in my mind, when you superimpose complexity of all the sensors, software, devices, the potential for human error is, in fact, non-negligible.
One of your criticisms is long-term, very difficult to fix in the short term, and that is the lack of money for research. How do you fix that in the face of this kind of disaster?
Well, it has been resolved in other countries in a very simple way. A small tax on gasoline can be used for research. Also, part of the lease fees can be used to support government-run research. There is no shortage of money. We could do a lot better in a hurry, but we need to kind of get started doing it.
All of us are becoming experts in the oil industry because we're watching this every day. And there's some moment where you think, has the development of the safety procedures kept pace with the technology of deep water drilling?
Well, you know, most of the time it has, because the results are in. Thousands of wells have been drilled with no mishap. My suggestion is that we need to really look back at all the historical mishaps. We need to look back at procedures that have been used by the different companies and also other industries, nuclear industry, airline industry, NASA, and then pick the best ways of avoiding accidents in the future and implement them in a smart way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tad Potsick is chairman of the Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering Department at the University of Texas at Austin.
Now to a little segment here on science and art. French Impressionist Claude Monet hopped across the English Channel and spent about 6 months in London painting images of the city. Two were bridges, Waterloo and Charing Cross. He painted them from a balcony of the Savoy Hotel. We know this now, and how we found out is really interesting. It's thanks to a meteorologist named John Thorns. He talked to Guy Raz this week.
How did you figure out where Monet was standing when he painted these bridges?
Well, it's really all to do with what we call solar geometry. So it's a case of working back from where the sun is in the actual images and sort of working backwards to work out where Monet actually stood.
And you're using sort of the sunlight as well to kind of triangulate? Is that sort of how you do it?
That's right. There are two words that we use. One is to work out what we call the azimuth, which is the sort of compass direction between the Savoy and the sun. And then the second angle is the angle of elevation, how high the sun is above the horizon. And from those two angles, we can work out exactly the date and time that Monet actually introduced the sun into his paintings. So we know that Monet, in the mornings, he used to work on the sun rising over Waterloo Bridge. And then by midday, the sun was shining almost along the Thames, looking to the south, looking over Charing Cross Bridge. And then he would go to St. Thomas's Hospital in the afternoon and watch the sun setting over the Houses of Parliament.
So what room was Monet in?
Well, the room numbers have all changed now. So if you went to the Savoy, you wouldn't recognise them at all. But it was the suite composed of a bedroom and a sitting room in those days. And it was 510 and 511 that he stayed in 1900 and 1901. And it was 610 and 611 in 1899. Now, the Savoy Hotel actually advertised the Monet suite, which they sell to the public before. Actually, it's closed for renovation at the moment. And they, in fact, used the suite, which was further down from where Monet actually was.
Wait, so the hotel is advertising the Monet suite, and people presumably are paying a lot to stay there, but that's not the room?
Indeed, they're paying thousands of pounds, yes, to stay
there. Oh, no. Are they offering refunds?
I don't think so, no. But they have assured us that when they reopen the Savoy in September this year, that they will have restored the Monet suite to the correct rooms.
Yeah, fair enough.
Partly as a result of our calculations, yes.
And I've read that these images actually by Monet actually give us a pretty accurate portrait of not just of the weather in London at that time, but the air quality as well.
Exactly, yes. That's one of the things we're very interested in, is how the air quality has improved since those days. Because obviously the levels of smoke and sulfur dioxide, particularly from coal burning then. So Monet's London series is a sort of visual coloured record of the London pea supers, as we now call them. And that's before the days of observation. So we're hoping, actually the study is continuing now, we're hoping to sort of work backwards and work out what the actual smoke levels were to give the visibilities in Monet's painting.
What does the location from where he chose to paint these paintings tell us about his style or his sort of method?
Well, it's really quite fascinating that Monet would spend so much time, almost 6 months of his life, actually at the Savoy Hotel, standing out in these terrible pea super fogs, which obviously affected his health eventually. But he was just so fascinated by the atmosphere and how the atmosphere changes every minute almost of the day. And this is what he called the envelope between, which he meant the atmosphere between him and the actual scenery, you know, the Houses of Parliament, the bridges and so on.
So are you looking at any other paintings now to try to figure out, you know, where they're painted from?
Well, yes. The next one to do, of course, is Monet's famous Impression Sunrise, which has the image of the sun rising in Le Havre. And that, of course, gave name to the whole Impressionist movement. But no one has actually looked at that to actually date that exactly. So that's our next target at the moment.
Will you get to spend some time in France?
I hope so, yes. We'll have to go over there, and it's hard work, isn't it?
That's a hardship assignment.
It is, yes, definitely.
That's John Thorns. He's a professor of applied meteorology at Birmingham University in the United Kingdom. Professor Thorns, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Over the last 2 weeks, NPR took a look at medical marijuana. Reporters looked at different states' laws as well as the social and economic impact of legalization. You can find those at npr.org. Richard Knox looked at the research behind medical marijuana. He talked to scientists and a few happy patients.
This is the story of a medical experiment that doesn't follow any of the rules of science. and it's one that people have very strong feelings about, from the patients who swear they benefit.
I think I probably would have passed away if I didn't have this drug.
To the doctors who recommend it.
Only for those patients who have reached an endpoint, there's nothing else left to give them.
To the scientists who don't really know how it works.
We're kind of stuck betwixt and between, quite honestly.
To the people who think it's a really bad idea.
Approving medical use of marijuana by political referendum is a slippery slope.
We'll hear more from all these people, but first, it's important to keep in mind that the federal government has an elaborate process for approving medicines, and it's highly unusual for states to bypass these rules. It's only happened once in recent memory. In the late 1970s, some states legalized the use of Laetril, a chemical made from apricot pits, as a cancer treatment. At least 50,000 cancer patients took it before it was exposed as totally useless. Now, 14 states and the District of Columbia have authorized a new experiment, the medical use of marijuana. If you want to understand why, meet Ellen Lennox Smith.
Hey, welcome.
I'm Ellen. Come on in.
Nice to meet you.
Smith is a lively, petite, 60-year-old grandmother, a former schoolteacher and athlete. When you first meet her, you don't suspect anything seriously wrong with her health. The only signs are a brace on her leg and her helper, Maggie, a black lab.
This is my service dog, Maggie. Maggie, say hello. Oh, good girl.
Among other things, Maggie's trained to open the refrigerator with a rope and pull food and medicine out. And once, when Smith stopped breathing, Maggie sensed something was wrong, jumped up on the bed, and licked her awake.
Maggie saved my life Thanksgiving morning. She's my lifeline, who sleeps next to me now.
Smith has two incurable diseases. One is ravaging her lungs. The other makes her tendons and ligaments loose and fragile.
My knee tore, and 2 weeks later, the other knee tore. And the same thing with my shoulder. It was one shoulder, then the other shoulder. So I was tearing like tissue paper, and no one knew why.
After years of misdiagnosis and surgical repairs, she found out she has a rare connective tissue disorder.
My condition causes pain throughout the entire body. And you get to the point that it keeps creeping in a little bit more and a little bit more, and you nudge up your medication to try to counteract it.
She had tried everything.
Smith's doctor, Pradeep Chopra.
Either the medicines weren't working or she was having a reaction to them.
Many people that have this condition live on morphine and Oxycontin, and I can't tolerate them.
She had absolutely no other option. So very, very hesitantly, I offered her, I said, listen, why don't you try medicinal marijuana?
And I can remember laughing and thinking, I wish my parents were alive to hear this conversation. You spend your life being told to stay away from certain things, and here I have a doctor suggesting it to help me.
She was a little worried. She was a little nervous. I reassured her. I said, look, you really don't have anything. So the choice is whether you live in this chronic disabling pain, or we try this and see what happens.
Smith's home state, Rhode Island, had just become the 11th to legalize medical marijuana. At the time, Chopra had never recommended marijuana and never imagined he would.
With medicinal marijuana, every patient is an experiment. You don't know if it's going to work or not. You don't know whether it's going to have any issues with them, problems with them. It's a little risk that we all take as physicians.
Smith got one of her adult sons to buy some pot from a friend. Because of her lung condition, she couldn't smoke it, so she soaked it in oil and stirred the oil into applesauce.
I tried it that night, scared to death. I mean, I had no idea what to expect. The only time I'd ever tried marijuana was once in college, and it was horrible. So I was really nervous about it, but it was so amazing. I took the oil, went to bed, and the next thing I know, it was morning. I had literally slept through the entire night for the first time in months.
She still has lots of pain every day, but she says marijuana has saved her life.
I'm deteriorating pretty rapidly. I honestly, and my husband says it too, I don't think I'd be here. I think I probably would have passed away if I didn't have this drug. I was rock bottom. There was nothing left to help me.
Ellen Smith is exactly the kind of patient legislators have in mind when they allow marijuana to be used as a medicine. But some think this is dangerous.
Approving medical use of marijuana by political referendum is a slippery slope. What's the next substance we'll approve by political referendum?
Joseph Califano heads a think tank on drug abuse. He was U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare during the Laetril period.
We have the best system in the world for clearing drugs in the Food and Drug Administration, and that's the system we should follow.
Interestingly, I didn't find very many people in the medical world who feel like Califano. The FDA doesn't support the use of medical marijuana, but a spokeswoman says the agency is open to proposals to study it. Others who I thought might be against it, like the National Institute on Drug Abuse, didn't want to talk about it. In fact, it seems possible that many authorities who once were dead set against medical marijuana are now not so sure. Take, for example, Glenn Hansen. He's a former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse and still advises them. He does drug research at the University of Utah, and he heads the Utah Addiction Center. Hansen knows a lot about the scientific evidence on marijuana. I ask him to run through a list of things that some people claim it's good for. Pain.
Yes, there's some significant evidence that it's useful in some types of pain.
Weight gain.
Yes.
Multiple sclerosis.
That's more controversial. There are clearly some individuals that have multiple sclerosis that say that it helps them.
Glaucoma.
There is some, but again, controversial.
What about seizures?
Again, some evidence that it may be useful in dealing with some seizures.
There are a lot more conditions that people say marijuana works for, but the point is there's evidence for some of those claims and not for others. The thing scientists are really excited about, Hansen says, is the discovery that cells in the human body and brain have special receptors for the chemicals in cannabis. For the last 10 years, they've been doing lots of research to figure out how these receptors work. They think it's really promising.
If you're asking, is this a system that can be targeted for therapeutic benefit, I think everybody that knows the scientific pieces would acknowledge that potential.
But much of the research is in test tubes in animals, not in real patients with real diseases. Human marijuana research is spotty. Studies are small and short. They have conflicting results. So there's a big gap between the testimonials, like Ellen Smith's, and the science.
The hardcore, rigorous science is taking place, but it hasn't caught up, and we've got a vacuum.
Hansen has no doubt that cannabis research will lead to important new designer drugs, but he has no idea when.
We don't know, is it going to be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? That doesn't satisfy and meet the needs of those people who are suffering today.
He says in the meantime, he has no problem with patients like Ellen Smith using marijuana.
I don't have any side effects. It's not deteriorating any internal organs. I mean, this is safer than anything else that's out there for pain relief.
Her doctor, Pradeep Chopra, said he'd like to have more solid evidence on marijuana, but it's the patients who are driving this movement.
The people have spoken. It's basically the people who have come up and said, it does help us, and look at us, we're doing well, and they're telling the establishment, you're wrong. And the establishment has listened to them.
At least important parts of the establishment. President Obama has said his administration has no interest in prosecuting doctors and patients who use marijuana, as long as their state allows it. Richard Knox, NPR News.
And that's it for this week's podcast. I'm Giselle Grayson.
And I'm Joe Palca. Next week, John Hamilton goes hunting for a rare toad at the edge of Death Valley. That and other stories right here on the podcast. Keep listening, and thanks for listening.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold